Ever wonder if there's more to the movies you love? Do you like to ponder how they got from A to Z? Who chose the plot twists? Why use those characters? Is there a deeper meaning? We're here to explore those questions and maybe learn a bit along the way. VGB Studios proudly presents The Filmlosophers.
Hello and welcome to another exciting episode of The Filmlosophers, the show that gets into the movies you love and digs a little deeper. I am your host, Eddie Villanueva, and alongside me, as always, is Mr. Spencer Bolo Young Williams.
Whatever, I don't even care.
Of course you care. Who gets walloped.
He did better in Bloodsport.
I was just going to say, he did much better in Bloodsport. But we are back again with another awesome episode, and we're actually here to talk about the latest in the honoring of Bruce Lee with a review of Enter the Dragon. So stick around as we talk about that, as we talk about some of the different aspects of it, as well as some of the things this film did that really broke that glass ceiling in the film industry. So, before we do, Spencer, don't you got something for him?
I do. Tune in each and every Wednesday morning on all your favorite streaming platforms and over on our website at filmlosophers.com. Also, connect with us on our social pages at facebook.com/filmlosophers and on Twitter and Instagram at filmlosophy101.
That's right. Check us out all over our social pages as well as our website. Got a lot of good stuff over there. It's been a very interesting month so far, and to say the least, having the opportunity to talk about this within the coolness of the AC, because it is hot as
ridiculous.
Hotness.
I don't even know what's happening outside. The world's literally
the world is ending, Spencer. Don't you get it? It's the only plausible reason, you know. We got pandemics and murder hornets and stuff, and so yeah,
you
it
know,
makes sense.
Real honest, it feels like the murder hornets were like 3 years ago when everyone was talking about that.
We had murder hornets and the pandemic and UFOs were confirmed, and yeah, it's just a
this
whole...
This has been a wild year. I forgot about half of that stuff.
And I'm pretty sure the other half of people are wishing they could forget.
Yeah.
But before anybody else forgets that they're listening to this episode, we're going to go ahead and jump into our review this week of Enter the Dragon. This film was debuted back in 1973, so I don't know if you've been listening to the last few episodes, you should really check them out, Lesson 228 and 229, because 228 was of The Big Boss, and 229 was of The Way of the Dragon. Those were kind of in that sequential order, because you had The Big Boss, I believe, which was in 71, and then you had The Way of the Dragon, which was in 72, and then you have Enter the Dragon, which is in 1973. So all these films happening in sequential order, and yet with that same mindset, you can see the progression with these movies in terms of his capability. So it's going to be an interesting conversation. We haven't talked about this yet off air, so this is going to be very interesting, and I'm kind of anxious to hear what Spencer has to say. But
yeah,
before he does... Spencer, give him that official synopsis goodness.
A powerful crime kingpin hosts a martial arts tournament on his iron lair. A former Shaolin monk is recruited by an intelligence agency to enter the tournament and expose the crime lord's opium and slavery rings. He finds himself fighting for his life alongside two Vietnam veterans who are both fleeing their own enemies.
Directed by Robert Klaus, the film stars Bruce Lee, John Saxon, Jim Kelly, and Kian Shi. As I mentioned earlier, it also showcases a couple other great cameos, because you get a cameo of Bolo Young, who happens to be, if his name doesn't sound familiar, he is the main antagonist in Bloodsport, as well as several other movies, mm-hmm. Martial art movies. You also have the introduction, if you will, of Jackie Chan into his career, so to speak. Jackie Chan was in this film on three different occasions, played an extra, but there's some great stories behind the scenes for that. This was essentially the first Chinese martial arts film produced by a major Hollywood studio, as Bruce Lee kind of wanted this movie to be a vehicle for expressing what he saw as the beauty of his Chinese culture rather than it just being an action film, which you have to appreciate. Somebody going to the extent of wanting to make sure that this isn't just another one of those movies that gets, you know, created just for the giggles of people who are wanting to, you know, I don't know, looking for fighting movies or whatever. That's not what he wanted. He didn't just want this to be about, like, beat him up, shoot him up, kick him, whatever's. He wanted it to be about an almost like a revelation to the Western world of the beauty of the Chinese culture. And you have to appreciate the efforts that they made, you know?
Mm-hmm.
This film definitely makes efforts into, like, highlighting, you know, the Shaolin monks and the artistry of their craft. And then even in the design aesthetic as well of, like, certain towns and certain places throughout that part of the world. It's really beautiful.
Yeah.
You know, there are those a lot of those aesthetics that you do see. So this was actually Bruce Lee's final film to feature his direct involvement. Several of his films after released after his death consist of archive footage from previous films. This was essentially the last film that he was directly a part of, with his knowledge, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
After the fact, there was a lot of other films that either he was a part of, whether if it was through the use of the extra footage or archive footage or whatever it may be. So it's definitely something of a treasure in that aspect alone, that this movie is honestly probably is our last glimpse into what could have been the makings of a long-lasting action star career.
Hmm.
You know, and that's kind of a bummer, but
it really is.
You know, like, Wes,
the improvements between each film was so massive that, like, he could have only gone up from here, and I really would like to have seen where that would have been. But
oh, 100%. I agree completely, because just, you know, just with, like you said, the improvements from year to year, not only were they substantial, but they were highly visible as well.
Mm-hmm.
You instantly saw, because, like we said, this one was made in 73. The Big Boss was made in 71. That's probably no more than about 2 to 3 years' time. And in about 2 to 3 years' time, he went from not having a single momentous scene in that film until, like, halfway through it, to this film where he's giving sage wisdom to other people and you know, be like, you know, it's everything that he does in there is just, like, it's so intentional and it's so, you know, meaningful, that you just see him all over that place, all over that film, just... It's got that, like, grace and beauty to it that he adds, you know. But of course, not to keep everything so down. another little tidbit is the production actually had trouble finding actresses to play prostitutes, so they actually ended up going and hiring real life prostitutes.
Gosh, it's the same thing every time.
It's like they took a page out of the Big Boss and they're like, you know what? We could just pay them this much and it'd be fine. It'd be fine. They don't have lines. They just got to act like, you know, themselves and we'll be good to go.
Oh, jeez.
You can't go wrong with their logic, Spence. It's like
you can't.
Yeah. It's like we need to get a real race car driver to play a role where they actually are in the pit and whatever and in with the pit crew and they're talking about their car and they're talking about this. What better way to get the best experience expressed on screen when it comes to this than to just hire straight from the source?
I'm sorry, but isn't that what being an actor is supposed to be? Is
sometimes
like making a believable impression that you are the source?
Well, Spence, it's like this. If you were on a plane and the pilot gets knocked out and then someone says, don't worry, we'll be okay. I once played a pilot in real life. I'd say there's more value in the source they pulled from than...
Like, I'm just not even going to really respond to that because that's the dumbest thing you could have said.
It's not. It makes perfect sense. The budget for this film was at $850,000, but its worldwide box office numbers brought in a little over $350 million. Now, I know, Spence, you're a big person in terms of inflation numbers.
Well,
so
it's
I did
important.
The inflation.
It doesn't mean anything if I don't know what 1970s money is meant for today.
It means money, Spencer. That's what it means.
Yes, but how much money? You could buy a lot more stuff with $1 million like back then.
Well, if you had $1 million back then, I'd say you were doing really well for yourself. But in terms of taking into account inflation, that actually amounted to $1 billion.
It's pretty good.
Yeah, it's really good. It's a little under three times the amount of money it made. So, but yeah, we're talking about Enter the Dragon, and this movie has got to be one of the most influential, one of the most impactful, one of the most famous Bruce Lee films to ever come out of his filmography. A lot of people will remember The Big Boss. A lot of people will remember The Way of the Dragon. This movie, by sheer numbers, is probably one of the more popular, if not is the most popular, Bruce Lee film to come out of him. And for good reason, because of the fact that this film really did so much to blow people away in terms of the expectation of Asians in cinema and just Asian cinema altogether, and creating something that nobody's ever seen before. And I think it's pretty clear to see that this was something that caught fire and caught wind really quick, because that whole movement after the fact of like Americanized martial arts cinema kind of just hit and took off, you know?
Mm-hmm.
You get a lot of those types of films like American Ninja, and then of course obviously things like the 80s is like full of all that, like with Bloodsport and with like Double Impact, and you have things where Dolph Lundgren came into the mix.
Oh, and gosh, we need to come back and do like a martial arts like 80s/90s.
No, thank you.
Come on, I want to talk about Bloodsport. Kumite, kumite, kumite.
Well, no. this was a movie that essentially set itself out to be something serious, because I'm pretty sure at the time, and interestingly enough, it's recognized a lot in Dragon, the Bruce Lee story, the movie, where at the time, a lot of Asian representation in cinema was stereotypical, and not just stereotypical, but offensively stereotypical. You know, you had actors, more than most times, white actors, who would, you know, put on the shoestring mustache, or slant the eyes, or put the buck teeth in, or not say the L sounds and just R sounds for L's. And I mean, a couple of prime examples, like you're looking at obviously like Breakfast at Tiffany's.
That was the one I was basically thinking you were describing.
Well, there's a lot of them. I mean, yeah. I mean, for God's sakes, John Wayne played Attila the Hun, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
Was it Attila the Hun? I'm trying to remember.
I thought it was.
But, I mean, you had a lot of actors at the time who were playing movies or a part of movies that just were not represented properly.
Right.
You know? And it's not to say that, well, maybe it is to say. I was going to say, it's not to say that people didn't know any better, because, I mean, there is a sense of, like, what?
I feel like people should have known better.
Well, honestly, oh, it's Genghis Khan. Sorry, Genghis Khan he played.
Mm, close enough.
Which, Genghis Khan, as many of us know, was Asian. he was a Mongolian ruler, wasn't he?
Yeah.
Yeah, Mongolian. Yeah, I was right. He played Genghis Khan. And mind you, this is just one of many. This is just in the serious aspects, like with Genghis Khan and, you know, John Wayne. Not to mention, like, every Bugs Bunny racial stereotype or cartoon just in general stereotype or, like just the recognition of how badly the Asian race, among others, were racially stereotyped in cinema and in media at the time. It's bonkers. So to have an opportunity where you can create a proper representation in a film that is rightfully theirs. I mean, let's be honest, the art of Kung Fu, the style of fighting, the art of fighting originated over there. Mm-hmm. And in the Asian countries, in the Asian continent, and in those cultures. And so it's at this point in time, there had to be somebody to stand up and say, all right, this is how you do it. Let's do it right. Okay. So before we jump into more of this movie, because I there's a lot of things I want to talk about and want to cover. Spencer, have you ever seen this movie before?
This
is the first
is
question I
one
have
of
to
the
ask.
Few movies I have seen before. We actually watched the episode.
You've actually seen it before.
Yeah. I remember like this is years ago, probably like mid 2000s. Where, you know, I'd heard Bruce Lee's name a lot, but like I had never seen any of his movies, and I'm like, I want to see one of this guy's movies because that sounds cool.
I want to see.
And my family had just gotten Netflix at the time. So
you and Netflix, yeah. There's like this, we're going to have a conversation about this. It's like this like eye-opening, you know, journey into a new life Spencer experience when it came to Netflix. Because Netflix also did it for you with Studio Ghibli.
Yeah, because you could get whatever you wanted from the mail. It was amazing. You didn't have to drive to dang Blockbuster. And I don't know why I'm giving Netflix an ad for their 2006 service, which they still have for some reason. But
yeah, I was going to say, man.
Yeah, it was like just world opening. So yeah, I remember I watched it back then. And I just remember being wildly impressed. Like, holy crap, that was amazing.
With Enter the Dragon?
Yeah, Enter the Dragon. Like the first time
so
I saw
this
it.
Was back in the mid 2000s.
Yeah.
Okay, just making sure. I'm getting numbers right. I'm just making sure. Because I'm pretty sure the next thing you're going to say is you haven't seen it since then.
Like, why am I even here if you're just going to predict what I'm going to say before I say it? It's just so rude, okay?
Was I right? I was right.
Yeah, of course you were right.
Of course I was right. It's me, of course.
Yeah. Yeah, that's exactly what the type of content I want to enable. So,
exactly.
Yeah. I hadn't seen it since then. I loved it the first time. Rewatching it, saw some new things, which was also very interesting, kind of wild, too.
Yeah.
There's something I didn't understand at the time that I definitely do now. And I was like, whoa, man.
No, I think I was in the same boat because I was like, I remember watching. So this was one of those ones that we saw quite often. But I remember seeing it a lot as a kid. I don't know if it's like it's a certain time in your life or whatever, but like when you get to a certain age where you know you've seen movies as a kid, so you spend X amount of time saying, oh, no, I've seen that. It's okay. No, I've actually seen that already. I don't want to see it again. Like, you say that so much for a certain part of your life that it then, like, 10 years go by and you're like, oh, my gosh, has it been 10 years since the last time I seen this movie? And I think that's kind of been the case for me with a couple of these films because it's been a while, and this is definitely one of them. I remember loving it as a kid, but I think to the same point you were thinking, like, I don't know if I fully understood a lot of the things that was happening, you know, Mr. Show me with darts, that kind of thing. I just, there's a lot of parts of this movie that I just don't recall. And watching it again, I was like, man, I need to turn my computer screen just in case anybody walks in. Thankfully, it wasn't the music this time. But still, this movie, had me like wondering, like, oh my gosh, this movie had a lot more stuff that I would be worried of watching if I was young. But nevertheless, it didn't change the fact that it was a good movie. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, I had enjoyed it when I was a kid, and rewatching it, I was actually anxious and excited to see it. Probably for the same reason that I've been saying for the last couple of times, with these movies, with these Bruce Lee martial arts films, in that I remember how much of an impact they were when I was younger. Mm-hmm. And rewatching them now as an adult, I just don't want to, I don't want to be disappointed, I guess, you know?
Oh, like it's going to ruin some like childhood, like vision of the movie or something?
Like if what I liked as a kid didn't really equate or was up to snuff to the standards I now have as an adult.
Oh,
like
which I know what you're talking about now.
You know what I'm talking about? Like, yeah. Which we all have. We all get to that point. You know, I just recently saw All Dogs Go to Heaven.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, this movie is not appropriate for children. Like, this had, like, drunken dogs and plots to kill people. And it's Spawn for dogs, essentially. That's what it is. All Dogs Go to Heaven is Spawn for dogs. He comes back to take revenge on the people who tried to kill him.
What?
Tell me I'm wrong. Okay. Tell me I'm wrong.
I don't remember that bit of the movie because it's been, like, I haven't seen that movie since the 90s. And now I feel like I'm going to have kind of the same reaction to it that you did.
Yep. Yep. But that's kind of just the same mindset or, like, the concern that I have with this film as well as all these other ones. I just want to make sure, like, going into the film, the expectation is that, like, I just want to make sure that these films don't subvert, like, my expectations. Because I still want to look at these with, like, that awe and wonder of, like, oh my gosh, you know, Bruce Lee just, like, swung his leg around and knocked off the head of somebody practically because it went so fast. Like, those scenes I remember as a kid, and I'm like, I want to make sure that, like, that same awe and ooh and wonder kind of mindset is still there, even as an adult. Because let's be honest, Bruce Lee was like a specimen all in his own. The man was capable of doing stuff that I don't think anybody even now has reached that level. And to watch him kind of have to gingerly tiptoe around so that way he could be visible on camera and he doesn't hurt anybody. And, like you know, this man could have whooped everybody in that entire department easily with one kick. And the fact that, you know, he's in this film, you realize he's doing it for American audiences. American audiences are slow. They don't catch on as quickly. So you realize, like, okay, this is the type of dynamic that he's got. So you don't, as an adult, you don't want to come in and like, oh my gosh, he did this, he did that, and then like have the realization, oh my gosh, this is like at half speed, this is like okay fighting, and it's just a bunch of, you know, white actors pretending they can say hee-haw, you know. that was the expectation, that was the concern, I guess, at the beginning. But first impressions rewatching again, Spencer?
Okay, well, so just first impressions as I was going through the movie, or just like I need more definition this week.
Did you? Okay, well, did you have any impressions while you were watching the movie?
Okay, there were several. mostly it has to do with, what's his name? Jim Kelly, who plays Williams in this movie.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Okay. I just found it interesting that one of his opening scenes is him dealing with the police and just,
yeah,
like, it was just wild. It's like, man, things don't change as much as you'd hope that they would.
Nope.
And the fact that, like, I now understand what the police called him, because originally the only connotation I had for that
I don't mean to laugh at this.
Yeah.
But the fact that, like, I'm looking at you and I realize prior to everything that's been happening this past summer, I'm pretty sure that word would have been right over your head.
No, I learned what that word meant like a few years ago, but not
okay.
But not that long ago. Like straight out of high school, Spencer didn't know what that word meant. Because the only connotation I had was the Irish dance. Like,
I was going to say.
Because I'm also into watching Riverdance in the 90s. So I had associated the word with that. So it just made zero sense. They were the dumbest police officers because of that. Like, I thought they were asking him to dance. It didn't make any sense. But now it's just a lot sadder.
Oh, my God. Yeah, I don't think that's what they were asking him to do.
Yeah, I know now. I've learned. I've grown as a person.
Okay,
so,
sure.
Yeah. I noticed that. Also noticed that the music in the movie tended to get funkier when he was on screen. Not that that's a complaint, just a thing I noticed. But it was fine. It was just a very odd choice. But I liked it, so it was fine.
It got funkier when he was on screen.
He became one of my favorite characters during this rewatch of the movie.
My gosh.
It was ridiculous what this man was doing. Also,
yeah, that was ridiculous.
Afros. Everyone had an afro. Like, that's like the black community I'm familiar with. Because, like, the black community I'm familiar with, everyone has, like, you know, different hairstyles, but no, everyone had an afro in that gym. It was.
Were you jealous?
I wasn't jealous. I'm learning how hard an afro actually is, because I'm learning things about myself that I don't necessarily know how I feel about during this quarantine season.
Well, at least I didn't call you Willie. Oh no, wait. Never
don't get yourself into trouble on our podcast, Eddie.
I was going to say, at least I didn't call you Spencer Williams.
Oh my gosh. Okay, what did you notice during your rewatch?
First thing I noticed was the voice of the old wise Shaolin monk is the same actor who plays the ailing father from Bloodsport. It's him. I know it's him. And he's all like, because as soon as he started talking, I'm like, you are not a Tanaka. I was waiting for that. I'm like, that's him.
Oh my God.
But I think one of the biggest things that I realized with rewatching this movie was the 70s was about drugs, man.
Yep.
Like everything was about drugs. And I'm like, this movie is about an island that makes drugs. And the last movie was about a mob boss who probably dealt in drugs. And his first movie was about a big boss who transported drugs.
Yeah.
I'm not saying there's a connection here.
No, you're just laying out all the work to make the assumption that there is a connection.
I'm just saying, you know, drugs. That's all I will say.
Uh-huh.
No, it's interesting how like the predicaments of most of these like 70s films is like, you know, we want to start a drug farm, or we want to start however drugs are grown or made. I don't know.
we want to start a drug farm. That's
I am 30 something years old, and I am happy to say I don't know how drugs are made. Walter White did not teach me well. but the fact that this movie is kind of really heavily emphasizing the idea of like this Shaolin monk decided to go into business for himself, bought himself an island.
Like just and, as a career turn, it's wild.
Yeah. It's like, how did he go from like serenity and the art of fighting and peace and tranquility and centering one's chi into, I'm gonna enslave women and beat up other people and grow drugs. Like, how does one do that?
I don't know. That's a really, really hard turn.
But that's not to say it doesn't make for interesting storytelling, which that's what this movie does. Mm-hmm. It has really interesting storytelling because the whole dynamic of the story is Han, who is the purveyor of this island and host, game master, if you will, of this tournament, is a former Shaolin monk who turned to a life of crime where apparently the only video footage that they got of the man is this one really high definition version footage that they have, and nobody else can get a camera on him. And he has a tournament. And honestly, I have to say, as I begin listening to this, listening to the movie and watching it, I'm like, I wonder if this is where Bloodsport got their story, their story element from. I'm like, because we all know Frank Dukes is a fraud. Like, the guy who Jean-Claude Van Damme is based off of, which this is supposedly a real story, the dude's a fraud. So he had to get his story from somewhere.
I'm never going to call someone who can possibly beat me up a fraud. So, like, even if it is true, okay.
How do you even know? The man might be as, like, acrobatic as Jim Carrey in, like, an In Living Color skit. We don't know what he can do.
Yeah, I don't know. That's the problem, Eddie. I have no data on what he's like now. I'm not going to risk some Jean-Claude clone coming up to my doorstep being like, you talk about me? And then just, like, oh, my head goes flying off in a direction? Uh-uh. Not today. I survived Corona. I'm not going to die to drugs.
I'm not going to succumb to some guy whose last name is D-U-X. But you have to admit, the story element to this, it's really, really unique. You got this really exclusive fighting tournament that's happening. These people, this small group of people are invited to attend and participate, which you don't really get a lot of the actual tournament. But still, you get the idea that it's not about the tournament per se, but it's more about what is happening behind the scenes. What is happening, you know, where all these people are apparently disappearing to and are washing up ashore of the nearby cities. So there's that whole story element. And then you get the unique story element of Bruce Lee's character, who is a monk who is recruited by this British government, because it's not an American government that recruits him. It's the British government, right?
I don't feel like they actually said, but he seems very British.
Seems extremely British.
Yeah.
And he's recruited to go undercover to this tournament to spy and figure out what's going on with this once former Shaolin monk turned pimp and drug dealer. All the while, you come to find out that Bruce Lee's sister was actually killed by the right-hand guy, no pun intended if you've seen the movie, the right-hand guy of the ex-former Shaolin monk, which is, it's very compelling stuff. I have to admit, I was compelled. I'm like, well, shoot, I have to watch this now. Like, it just, you find yourself like, I need to know what happens. Where did he get a scar? Who's got a scar? Like, you find out all these elements and you're seeing things and you're like, all right. We got to see how this plays out. Obviously, Bruce Lee is a phenomenal part of this film. He's absolutely, like, a refined performer at this point in time. I don't know if he, like, attended intense acting school or something, or if, like, the honing of his fighting craft just made him more confident in his ability to act, but he was phenomenal, hands down. Then you get people like John Saxon, who played Roper, which mind you, out of the three of them, Bruce Lee's character, John Saxon, and Jim Kelly's character, I think John Saxon's character is the one I kind of was like, I don't know why you're here. Like, I just did. Because it's like John Saxon is this gambling addict who literally has, like, it's like an inside joke. Every time he says, you want to bet, it's like, bwah, bwah. Like, you expected that sound to go off because it's like, oh, John. Like, you expected the whole audience to start laughing or something. But, like, seriously, this man had a gambling problem. He was approached by handlers, if you will, on a golf course for $150,000. $150,000 back in the 70s. Like, I don't know what that is in inflation, but that's a lot of money.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure you could just buy a house with that money and have some money left over for, like, you know, a steak.
Buy a house? Houses back then were like $30,000. You could buy several. It's like, oh my gosh. And so John Saxon's character was very interesting. I don't know if I really... I know the reasons why he was in the story, but I don't know if it was all that necessary, I guess. You know?
It wasn't necessary, but it was nice. Like, I liked having him in the movie because I kind of liked how him and Williams were kind of like, you know, the old war buddies, is what I think.
They were like, because, I mean, they have that one interaction. Hey, Williams. Hey, Roper. How's it going? Haven't seen you since Nam. What have you been up to? Nothing. Okay, cool. Catch you later. It's like, all right. I mean, that was like the one moment of them bonding. But after the fact, like, they do hustle some old Asian man out of his money during a fight.
Yep.
But other than that, there's no real connection between the two. Which is why I think in terms of performance wise, like, I like Bruce Lee's and Jim Kelly's dynamic a little better. There's no, like, emotional connection. However, at the same time, you have this really great, you know, dynamic between Jim Kelly, who, let's be honest, Jim Kelly is he's eye candy for people. Like, just be honest. Like, that man is tall. He is strong. He was there so that he could bring in the ladies to the theater. But not just that. He's capable, too. And on top of that, whoever wrote... Well, we know who wrote it, obviously. Michael Alin. But the writing on this was so superb in creating Williams to be not just somebody who is another fighter, but he's somebody who is also dealing with being black in this time of the world, like you were mentioning earlier. That whole beginning scene is like the stark reminder that, yeah, Williams is a fighter, but in some people's eyes, he's still nothing but that word, mm-hmm. You know?
Yeah.
And if you're just tuning in and you just hear me say that, I don't mean that word. I mean the word that the police use to refer to him, which we just mentioned a little bit ago. Yep. I just don't want to be taken out of context.
Yeah,
that's all I'm saying.
Don't even say it. Someone record it and then just play it back in some nonsensical fashion.
No, I'm okay. I choose life. But I like that because Williams is somebody who is confident. He is sure. He, even though he knows what it's like to be, you know, to have the deck stacked against him and to, you know, to be behind the eight ball, he still knows his biggest asset, if you will, is having the forward moving mentality. Like, he's just going to keep on trucking. He doesn't think about defeat because he's focused on just winning.
Did you just keep on trucking because it's the 70s?
Oh, my gosh. No, I did not. I didn't even think about it. It's rubbing off. But Williams is, I feel like, one of the best characters in the film.
Yeah,
awesome. Next to Bruce Lee. Han, I have to be honest, I thought the actor who played Han, Qian Shi, I thought he was older. Like, at first, I thought the first time I had seen it through, I thought there was like a stunt double for the guy.
Huh.
When I was younger, rewatching it, I realized that guy is doing all those fighting moves. Like, that dude is, like, legit. He's similar to the guy from The Big Boss. He's in there. He's fighting. I mean, he does have a magical hand because there's
that hand.
Like, continuity-wise, I don't know if anybody paid attention to that hand because there were a lot of early scenes where he was closing and opening that hand and whatever, and then he takes off the glove and it's metal or it's iron, and it's like, yeah, I'm pretty sure you were bending fingers just a little bit ago. But hey, I'm not one to poke at it. It's fine. But the fact remains is that the guy who plays him is a really great actor, you know, and he really is very physical for him playing the older Shaolin monk, ex-Shaolin monk turned drug dealer and pimp. And hey, you got to give credit to where credit is due. It was really good seeing Robert Hall reappear. I haven't seen him in any other film other than The Way of the Dragon and then this film. He's O'Hara. Guy with the scar, because he plays Chuck Norris's student in The Way of the Dragon, and then he comes back in this one and is in this one, but playing the right-hand guy to Han.
They really like to keep a similar group of actors, don't they?
I mean, if they work, why not?
Yeah, that's true.
Because, I mean, you go with somebody like Bolo Young, who, oddly enough, in this film, plays a character named Bolo.
You know. You just
seriously.
Why remember a name? Just use your own name.
I don't know if really a lot of people know him. Like, oh, well, he's Chung Li in Bloodsport, isn't he?
Yeah.
Is it sad that we are dying to talk about Bloodsport so much that we're just constantly putting it into this movie?
Hey, he popped up in there. Like, that's the reason we're talking about it.
But Bolo's character itself, I mean, it's very synonymous to, like, what he's used to playing, which he plays he usually plays on the protagonist side. He's always somebody, or the antagonist, sorry.
Yeah.
He always plays on the antagonist side. He always plays the characters that are always, like, against the good guys. He's somebody who's he's just always plays an enemy.
But he's fantastic at it, though. he really is.
And guy. I mean, have you seen those eyebrows? That man just has to, like, furrow his eyebrows and makes you scared, like, makes you want to pee yourself.
Plus, in this movie, like, well, he always looks like this, but he's just so freaking huge. It's ridiculous.
Yeah, yeah. He is, and I don't know if it's, like, just because of this particular film or it's because it's a younger film, but, like, I mean, he does get bigger. I mean, because we've seen him in Bloodsport, going back to Bloodsport. he's massive in that one as well. Yeah, I'm looking at pictures of him. Yep, the man's huge. One of the great little tidbits of this film that a lot of people don't really know is that the film also features some of the starting opportunities for Jackie Chan, one of the more current famous martial arts actors in the business right now. And he played actually one of the thugs in the prison. He actually got hit by Bruce Lee in that scene while he was underground. The story goes is that they were doing the scene and he actually ended up getting hit, I think, with a nunchuck by Bruce Lee, and as soon as Bruce Lee hit him, he dropped the nunchucks or something and went over to him and apologized and told him he was sorry and said that essentially, I think Jackie Chan said that Bruce Lee promised that he would put him in all of his films to make up for it. Now, unfortunately,
that's so sad.
That's not the case for the man, because this wasn't. Yeah. But either way, goes to the heart of the man of who is Bruce Lee. There are several aspects of this film that are just so unique and so mind blowing. Because you have one of the first opportunities, as we mentioned earlier, to have proper representation in cinema by Chinese actors, by Asian actors, just by the Asian culture itself, which even more so now, you recognize the importance of what Bruce Lee was trying to do with this film, debuting it with, I think it was Warner Brothers? I know it was a big WB.
I'm pretty sure it is.
Warner Communications Company, which I think is just the beginnings of Warner Brothers.
Yeah, you know how they like to switch up their names and be different companies at different points in time.
Yeah, exactly. But mind you, all this to say, like, one of the greatest things about this movie is that this is one of the true opportunities where, like you said, I think you hit it on the head a little bit ago. We had a brief, wonderful, if not unfortunately brief, glimpse of what that kind of career could have looked like, in terms of kung fu in the Western cinematic world, or even just proper representation of Asian styles of fighting. It doesn't even need to be just fighting. It could be just acting altogether, too, because you had phenomenal acting in this film from all walks of life. And that's what makes this film so great. This film is essentially like the melting pot of what movies were beginning to or were going to head towards within the next few years. Because obviously after 73, you had a whole spurn of like martial arts films that came out after that. Movies that were about, you know, being the one man against all odds. And you have to give credit to where credit is due. Bruce Lee put in the work. Bruce Lee was the man who made it so unique and so iconic. I mean, in 2004, this movie was actually deemed, quote, culturally, historically, and aesthetically significant in the United States and selected for preservation in the National Film Registry over at the Library of Congress. This movie had become such an icon and such an impactful piece of cinema that we had to have Congress, we had to have people in official roles deem it as such, so that way it could be preserved for future people to see as the years went on. And mind you, one of the great things about this film is also the opportunity to see facets of other people. Like, who knew John Saxon at the time knew how to fight? Like, John Saxon, I only knew John Saxon from, to be quite honest, the first Halloween movie. He's the father to one of the girls that ends up getting killed. No, I'm sorry, not Halloween. What am I talking about? Nightmare on Elm Street. That's what it was, because he's the father to the main girl in Nightmare on Elm Street. So he fights Freddy Krueger. But even things like with like with Jim Kelly going on, and after even Enter the Dragon, do things like Black Belt Jones and even like Hot Potato, and bringing in that whole not blaxploitation era, but like what we now consider like Black Dynamite and things like that, Michael Jai White and all that. Like, he ushered a lot of that in with like Black Samurai, you know, and just a lot of the movies that he brought into American cinema, but not just the American cinema, but even giving a foothold into cinema for African Americans to be able to come in and do stuff, you know, like I said, with Black Samurai and, you know, Black Belt Jones, Mr. No Legs, and even Death Dimension back in 1978. You know, you have all these movies who help create this new sense of opportunities for African Americans at that time. And a lot to, like with you, Spencer, when we had that conversation about Black Panther, and you being able to see somebody who you look like on screen playing a role as heroic as Black Panther. Like, imagine kids back in the days, you know, back in the early 80s and late 70s, who, after seeing all these people, you know, even in comic books at the time, this is when, like, Shang-Chi and, you know, what's his name? Iron Fist and all these other comic books, not to mention movies, were coming about, having opportunities, seeing things like Black Samurai or even, what's his name? Jones, Marvel's character. The one that was on Netflix.
You're talking about Luke Cage?
Luke Cage. I'm sorry. I was thinking Jessica Jones.
Yes.
Luke Cage, yeah. Even around that time when Luke Cage was coming out into comics, like having the representation to where kids at the time could see, like, oh my gosh, I could be a ninja. I could be a hero. I could be this. I could be that. You know, this was around that time. What?
Well, no, I was just thinking, you know, well, you shouldn't encourage your kids to become a ninja.
What's wrong with it?
It's not a practical field.
Nobody encourages their children to become Black Panther.
I mean, I guess.
I mean, it. No. I'm just saying, the opportunities are there. And the opportunity to see yourself represented in something other than just, I don't know, like a slavery movie or a movie about.
Honestly, yes. Because, like, honestly, that's pretty much like, there's such a saturation with slave movies. Like, yes, we get it. Black people were slaves in the past. Blah, 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 blah. Like, can we do something else? Like, it's that's why it's so nice
over on the ship.
To just, like, have other movies out there that might, like, not focus on a historical context, but, like, are just placed somewhere else, you know? Like, you know, this movie, Enter the Dragon. It was nice seeing Jim Kelly in it. Like, there's other things. Like, seeing, taking from a similar time period, Uhura on, like, the bridge of, like, the Enterprise back in the day. That was pretty important for a lot of people. So, like, representation, like, really matters for, like, just everyone.
I agree. And it's one of those situations where I don't know if, like, because, I mean, let's just be honest. Bruce Lee was, like, way ahead of his time.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I don't know if it's kind of safe to say it or not, but, like, the man had a time machine. Like, there's no way this man could not have, like, gone and, did all these things and made all these attempts and made all these changes without knowing, like, how much of an impact it was going to have later down the road, you know? I don't know. Yeah. Like, maybe a crystal ball?
I don't know. He might just be a visionary. He knew, like, you know, he had to get his style out there. And, like, that kind of just paved the way for, like, so many people to follow him.
And that's one of those areas where it's, like, I think it's part of the pain of realizing there was still so much more room to grow. And now that the field was opening up for him, he had so much more opportunity to just take off from there.
Yeah.
And so with everything happening and him passing, it's kind of like a shame. It is like a shame. It's a shame of the fact that, you know, the world was robbed too early of experiencing what else this man would have exposed to the world in terms of opportunities in cinema and the full honest look and perception of what Asian cinema could really become.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, who knows? If Bruce Lee had still been alive, can you imagine where Asian cinema could have been right now in comparison to where it is now? Like, where Asian cinema could have, like, skyrocketed to and kind of be at, like, at a status level because of everything Bruce Lee was continuing to do, and not where it is now, where, let's be honest, Asian cinema was never really popular for a good portion of time.
Mm-hmm.
Unless it was a kung fu movie or unless it was a movie that had like certain like Western appeals, there's not really many Asian films that blew out of the box offices.
No,
you know, it probably wasn't until like opportunities like Crazy Rich Asians.
No, you know, that.
You know, and movies like that that really reset the landscape for Asian cinema to be like, hey, Asian cinema doesn't just have to be about like fighting each other and, you know, swords and kicks and nunchucks. It can be comedy. It can be drama. It can be family drama. It can be and I think that's one of the things like I really enjoy. Full disclosure, I actually really like some Korean dramas. They're like novellas, but made in Korea.
Yeah.
But the idea of the fact of like some of these stories, how they intermingle with some of them intermingle with lore and the ideas of how they come about and how they're created. It's just a unique aspect of another form of cinema that I'm not used to. And I enjoyed Crazy Rich Asians. I know that there's a lot of movies like we just recently talked about Parasite, which was, when was that?
Oh, that was good.
What was it?
Parasite was a good one.
No, I'm saying though, when was that?
When did we watch it or when did it release?
When did it release?
Oh, I was totally going for the other question.
I'm trying to remember.
2019? Yep.
But like with Parasite, Parasite was a great example. There's a movie back in 2019 that was also really great. I haven't had a chance to see it, but like The Farewell with Awkwafina, that apparently has been a really great movie that's getting a lot of reviews. There's a lot of these movies. And it's crazy because these movies are not any different in terms of like, oh, well, you can't like them because they're like low budget or whatever. No, these movies are done by like great studios. They're done by really great directors and filmmakers. And it's just the need for us to open our eyes to things like that and really kind of expose ourselves to this kind of cinema, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But it isn't, unfortunately, that way. And Bruce Lee is no longer, you know, was no longer with us in the past. And cinema is what it is. But thankfully, there's a lot of people who are taking the opportunity and restructuring the landscape, you know, and, you know, really kind of resetting how everybody is viewing Asian cinema. You know, Bong Joon-ho, the director of Parasite, is really known for doing that as well, doing everything from what would you even call Parasite? Like a drama thriller?
Like, I'm to like, be perfectly honest, I have no idea how to categorize that movie. It's fantastic and I love it, but it's just like a social commentary movie. It's the best I can come up with.
Exactly. Like a social commentary thriller. You know, he does that to, you know, to sci-fi with what's it called? Oh my gosh. Snowpiercer. Sorry, Snowpiercer. He did Snowpiercer. He did that movie on Netflix, that Okja.
I don't remember that.
He did
one.
That one.
Okay.
It's a one about a big mythical creature that follows a girl around.
Oh no, I've seen the trailer for that one. Yes. Okay.
Oh, you have seen it.
The trailer for that one.
The trailer. Yeah, yeah. But like, this is somebody who's doing things like that. There's a ton more out there. There's a ton of actresses. We just mentioned Awkwafina. There's Michelle Yeoh. There's Henry Gold. Is that his name?
No, Golding. You had it right.
There's a ton of people out there who are really kind of reshaping how people view Asian cinema, and not just that, but people who are in television, people who are in TV, who are trying to reestablish how Asian actors and actresses should be treated. And that's a great thing, because let's be honest, the things that they were facing back then, mm-hmm. in terms of discrimination in films and in stuff like that, it's kind of the same way things are happening now still.
Yeah.
Like, unfortunately, not much has changed. And, yeah, it's sad, but, you know, it's not anything we can't fix the past. All we can do is try to move towards writing the future, you know?
Yeah.
So, but I digress. Coming back around to Enter the Dragon, as we wrap up this conversation, Spence, did you have any last thoughts? Anything in terms of, you know, drug use or you know,
just... Really, my only complaint with this movie is that they killed off Jim Kelly, my favorite character. And
that is true. They did. They killed him bad, too.
Yeah, that's my only complaint. And then they were so theatrical about his death, too. They, like, just maneuvered his body over a pit of water and then dropped him in it just to have
not
a show.
Even that. It was a pit of water that had, like, teeth. It's like, was that necessary?
Was that supposed to be like, acid?
The pit had, like, teeth around it.
Oh,
like,
that's what you mean, yeah.
Yeah, that's why I'm like, why did it need teeth? Like,
what's more aggressive than teeth?
Well, what? Was it going to close on it or something? It's like a flycatch, or what are those called? A Venus flytrap?
Mm-hmm.
Like, as soon as it falls in, then, whoom, like, just eats it? I don't know.
It could be. He could be a villain that likes to laugh at things. Make me laugh.
True. Very true. I mean, his hands were pretty laughable. he actually had his
interchangeable hands.
He had interchangeable hands, which was very interesting, but it didn't look like they locked into his wooden peg. And then when you see the reveal and he takes off the glove, that hand is like vastly smaller than his like actual hand. His other hand's like this and his other one's like this. And it's like, yeah, no, that's not the case. So
yes, it's very clearly a man holding a metal claw with his regular hand.
Well, wrapping this up, let's go ahead and go and talk about whether or not the film passes or fails and how many monocles. I'll go ahead and kick this off because I know I usually throw it to you first, but I'll do it first this time.
Okay.
And the film passes for me. It's definitely a step above all the previous films in terms of cinema quality. Bruce Lee really is in his full element here, not only in his fighting element, but even in his speaking element, his ability to give sage and sound wisdom. Him recognizing that he is a Shaolin monk in this film makes total sense because he is very wise. Like, he doesn't get into a fight if he doesn't need to. He doesn't, you know, there's nothing there is nothing outside of necessity that he won't do. So, wait, he won't do anything outside of necessity. Everything he does is intentional and purposeful. Even in terms of, like, getting, having a guy try to pick a fight with him on a boat, he literally strands this guy on a little dinghy and has the other people hold on to the dinghy while they sail through. Like, instead of him going,
that guy's fault. That guy sucked.
He did. He royally sucked. But yeah, the film passes. It's definitely one of those movies that exceeds all of my expectations when it comes to Asian cinema and what you would hope to see when it comes to the first entries into what is known as great Asian cinema on that scope. In terms of monocles, I'm going to give it a 4.75. The point 25 is kind of the lack of fighting, technically, of like the tournament fighting.
So you're doing this fighting movie on the fact that they had less tournament sanctioned fighting.
Yes. because I wanted to see everybody kind of a little bit more, kind of like with Bloodsport, I guess. Oh my gosh.
Just watch Bloodsport.
I think we're going to have to.
Yeah, it's happening.
It doesn't really do much in terms of explore that aspect. And at only sitting at an hour and a half, you can understand why. The film isn't that long. It does have a lot of great moments in the film, and you do appreciate a lot of the aspects of the film. However, I think, so part of that point 24 is the lack of tournament fighting, but also I kind of wanted to see that guy's daughters like actually fight.
You know what? That is one of the few disappointing things of the movie, because like they did set up the daughters to be like these super badass women who can like they will mess you up. And then they do nothing.
They're like super. They're super dangerous to apples. I learned that.
That's right.
They're like super dangerous.
I like apples.
So it's like, oh my gosh, I don't want to be an apple around them. But everything else, I felt like I was pretty safe, except for being John Saxon walking into that place and getting flipped over.
He deserved that.
You did deserve that. But yeah, so 4.75. Yeah, and that's kind of where I'm at. What about you, Spence?
Okay, this movie definitely passes for me. It's just an amazing martial arts film that I really liked. I'm going to have to give it a 5 out of 5 because it's just something that everyone kind of really needs to see. Like, yeah, it's from the 70s, whatever. It's still super good. It holds up pretty well. It's still got relatable themes, no matter how sad that is. So it's still worth seeing.
There you go. There you go. 5 stars, 5 monocles out of 5 monocles.
Yep.
Huh? There you go. Well, that about wraps up another awesome episode of the Filmlosophers. Remember, you can catch us on our website at filmlosophers.com. There we have over 200 episodes, 230 actually to be exact with this one.
Yes.
And you can check us out on our website. You can check us out also on all of our streaming platforms. We are on iTunes, Google Play, Libsyn, Stitcher, Player FM,
okay,
Audio
we're
Boom.
On all of them. If you find one we're not them. On, you should tell us. We'll see what we
and we'll
it.
Try to put ourselves on there. And of course, check out our last couple of episodes as we continue to honor Bruce Lee this month and the films that he's done. We got one more month. We have one more week and one more film, so maybe you might know which one we're going to pick. Maybe you don't. I mean, there's a couple to choose from. So
literally a couple.
Yeah, Spence, literally a couple. But yeah, tune in next week and find out which one we're talking about, and we can't wait to share it with you. So from all of us here at the Filmlosophers, I'm Eddie.
I'm Spence.
Class dismissed.